supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
A neck-and-neck state house race in Chester County may have uncovered a gray area in Pennsylvania's election law, leaving 14 provisional ballots in murky territory. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. WHYY's Laura Benshoff reports that candidates for the 156th legislative district were in court today, arguing about whether these and other votes should count.
The ballots in question were all submitted by citizens registered to vote by Fieldworks, a national left-leaning group currently under investigation for voter fraud in Pennsylvania. Last week, the Chester County Board of Elections rejected ballots from 14 people the group registered. Not because they were fraudulent, they weren't, but because the registrations came to the county too late in the mail. Democratic candidate and Westchester Mayor Carolyn Comita says that's not right.
We believe that they were registered appropriately, and they cast their provisional ballots, and they should be counted.
Here's the issue. The registrations were postmarked on time, but sent to the Department of State, not to the County Board of Elections. A judge now has to decide whether the Department of State is allowed to officially receive them. A representative from that department, which oversees Pennsylvania's election process, testified it's been common practice for years, and many other state agencies are also allowed to receive registrations. In court, Judge Jacqueline Cody quipped, it's not as though they were sent to Wawa. But state law isn't absolutely clear on the matter, says 156th Republican incumbent Dan Truitt.
My last 6 years inside government, I find that that's not uncommon. Practices are set into place that are inconsistent with state law, but if no one ever challenges it, it never gets sorted out.
Truitt now trails by 18 votes in the race. He says once these ballots are hashed out and the results certified, he's going to call for a recount. As for Fieldworks' other registrations, more than 1,000 of them were deemed valid in Delaware County, and those voters' ballots counted. Judge Cody said not to expect a ruling on the Chester County ballots before Monday. For WHYY, I'm Laura Benshoff.
Philadelphia elections officials are granting a request to recount presidential election results in 75 precincts. But they're rejecting a Green Party request to inspect election software on those machines for malware that could have manipulated votes. Philadelphia's decision today comes amid a broader Green Party push for a statewide recount in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. Those are states where Donald Trump narrowly beat Hillary Clinton. The calls for recount claim voting machines can be hacked easily, but just how susceptible are they? Here to offer perspective is Penny Venetis. She's a professor at the Rutgers Law School and is spending a sabbatical as the executive vice president and legal director at Legal Momentum. It's a women's legal defense and education fund. She spoke with WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies.
Well, Penny Venetis, welcome to NewsWorks Tonight. In 2004, you were the attorney in a lawsuit about concerns about electronic voting machines in New Jersey. What was the problem you were trying to address in that case?
Well, a computerized voting machine is like any computer. You can program it to do whatever you want. You can program a voting machine, computerized voting machines, to play chess if you'd like. You can also program a computerized voting machine to cheat on elections and erase its tracks and lie to you to say that it didn't cheat. Computer scientists around the country raised concerns about this vulnerability, and we brought a lawsuit saying that unless you can check the votes that were cast on computerized voting machines, that those computers run afoul of the First Amendment and state laws that require that every vote be counted as cast.
And when you say check the votes, you mean produce a written record of each voter's ballot choices?
Well, it's not that you want the computer to provide the record, because then it can provide a false record. What you want is an independent way to verify the computer, what is called a voter-verified paper ballot or a voter-verified paper audit trail. They mean the same thing. So you really need something that the voter, her or himself, actually has touched and filled out that then can serve as the actual ballot in the event that there is a challenge or in the event of a recount. And the way to do that is to have a precinct-based optical scan system where a voter will fill out a paper ballot. That paper ballot is scanned so that it can be tabulated. The paper ballot is kept so that, again, in the event of a recount or a challenge, the authorities that are conducting the recount can actually go to the paper ballot itself and count the ballot. Now, the paper ballots themselves don't really mean anything unless there is actually a way to audit the system. So in addition to having the paper ballots scanned, it's really critical to actually audit a certain percentage of the paper ballots in every precinct to ensure that the voting machines are counting the ballots properly. And there are states in the U.S. that actually require that to happen.
You know, the consultants in the Jill Stein challenge in Pennsylvania say that it's entirely plausible that malware could have been inserted in voting machines, which would conceal itself until Election Day, shave off some votes, and then erase itself so that no one would be the wiser. Based on your experience in the case in New Jersey, is that plausible?
Oh, it's yes, it is, because we did the exact same thing with a voting machine in New Jersey. The chair of the Princeton Computer Science Department was able to to modify the vote counting program in the voting machines used in New Jersey, which are also used in Pennsylvania and parts of Pennsylvania, and change 9 lines worth of code. And that made the voting machine switch votes from candidate A to candidate B for a discrete period of time and then stop switching votes at another period of time and then to erase its tracks to say that that never happened. So it certainly is, it's doable, and it's certainly not particularly difficult to do to actually create that malware. One does not have to be the head of the Princeton Computer Science Department to do that.
The Stein campaign says in their recount they need direct access to machines and the voting technology to search for evidence of hacking. Can you find it by looking at a machine after the fact?
You can. You can find it. You would also need to know what the program looked like before the hacking as well. You need people who are skilled computer security experts to do the analysis. But you should be able to find traces of hacking if you look in the right places and you do the correct analysis. You would need to have access to the program itself to see what a program that wasn't compromised looked like, a vote counting program that wasn't compromised looked like. And then you would need to compare it with whatever you would have in a compromised machine. But that really would take a lot of time and a lot of effort to go through all of the voting machines. And it seems, again, this is sort of a point to emphasize, that if there were a voter-verified paper ballot system in place, it would actually be really, really easy to do the recount.
Penny Vanettis, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rutgers law professor Penny Vanettis speaking with WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies. A funding standoff between Democratic Governor Tom Wolf and the GOP-led Senate has led to terse public letters, rallies, and come the middle of the month, several hundred state employee layoffs. WHYY's Katie Meyer takes a look at how a funding bill for the state's unemployment compensation program turned into a partisan battle.
It's dark and raining heavily in downtown York. But on the side of the road, a group of about a dozen people carrying union signs are undeterred, protesting outside of the district office of Republican Senator Scott Wagner. Many work in the state's unemployment compensation program, or at least they do for now. Come December 19th, an estimated 521 of them and their co-workers are being laid off due to a funding deficit. Jennifer Mascaro, a protester whose husband is among the furloughed workers, says this has made the past several weeks a nightmare.
Well, we have a daughter going to college. It's going to hurt trying to figure out her college. I'm going to college. Got to figure out how to pay for that. It's going to hurt a lot of people's futures.
The layoffs were announced after the Senate opted not to vote for a proposal that would have tacked a year onto a funding stream allocated to the program several years ago. Wagner, a first-term senator, has taken credit for leading the charge against the bill, thus the protests outside his office. In a statement aimed at the protesters, Wagner said the layoffs aren't on him or the Senate leadership.
Your union, which you pay dues to, should even be considering some type of legal action to force Governor Wolf to halt the closure of the call centers. But in fact, your union has you standing in front of my office holding a sign. Your union cares more about protecting Governor Wolf politically than they do about protecting your jobs.
The rest of the Senate's GOP leadership has also taken that stance, saying the governor didn't offer a clear enough plan for the funding. But Wolf and Democrats in the legislature say that's just an excuse. So does the union that represents many of the furloughed workers. Stephen Catanese with SEIU Local 668 says the situation didn't have to turn into such a big issue.
It's hard to be optimistic when something so simple and easy there is to do. And for whatever purpose of grandstanding or intransigence, can't even get an up or down vote to not break the unemployment system. So I would like to be optimistic, but I think things are going to get bad, and I hope not, but I have my worries.
So who's in the right? Well, there is no easy answer. The issue dates back to 2012, when the state established a service infrastructure improvement program to help pay for computer system upgrades while maintaining decent service in unemployment compensation centers around the state. It was intended to be a four-year cash stream, but Department of Labor and Industry spokeswoman Sarah Goulet says the program needs at least one more year of funding in order to finish its upgrades. Specifically, she says the agency was reluctant to hurry into a contract to update its computer system.
The department made the decision to say, okay, we're not going to hurry into a contract with someone who can help us with this modernization. We're going to take our time. We're going to have some consulting. We're going to really look at how we can best do this most efficiently, effectively, and not go over budget on it. And so I feel like we're sort of being punished for that.
The governor's office says it first broached the funding extension in April of this year. An initial request asked for an additional 4 years of funding, although the final bill would have only added one. In the months following the move, administration spokesman Jeff Sheridan says the governor ultimately sent the legislature six documents, variously describing how the previous funding had been spent and why more was warranted. He says countless meetings were also held.
They can say all they want that they didn't receive the necessary information that they requested from us, but the governor outlined a very comprehensive six-month timeline of information that was provided at the request of the Senate to them. It is untrue that they did not receive the information that they asked for on several different occasions.
But the Senate GOP contends the administration's proposals were always too vague. Jen Coker, spokeswoman for Senate Republicans, says, for instance, the chamber asked for a date by which the UC program would no longer need the funding stream. They never received it.
We were looking for a plan. These are all very nice sentences that talk about high-level things, but nowhere is there a plan.
Meanwhile, in UC offices across the state, more than 500 employees are preparing to be out of the job. Lori Haynes is an adjudication supervisor in the department and has worked there for 16 years. She says it feels like workers are being used as tokens, like they're political collateral.
My thing is, it should be people over politics.
The night of the rally was also the last day of the 2016 legislative session, the absolute latest the Senate could have voted on the funding bill. Haynes and her fellow protesters say they weren't really expecting a vote, but she says the situation does feel more hopeless now.
Frustration, hurt, we've become family. And now, after so many years, we're going to lose that. It's everyone possibly losing their homes, their cars. I mean, this was our livelihood for so long.
Goulet says the layoffs will disproportionately affect staff in the Commonwealth's seven UC service call centers across the state. She says fewer employees will probably mean longer wait times for callers. So far, no alternative plans have been proposed for avoiding layoffs. Katie Meyer in Harrisburg.
In Upper Darby, a female-focused auto shop has just opened with the goal of empowering women to pop the hood and crawl under their cars. WHYY's Bobby Allen spun through the shop with the woman who started the business.
Wearing a backwards red ball cap, skinny jeans, and high-heel boots, Patrice Banks is doing her thing at the Girls Auto Clinic.
That boom, boom noise that you hear at a shop is called an impact gun.
Spreading the mechanical gospel is in Banks' blood.
And it's connected to compressed air. And so what that does is it removes bolts and nuts and stuff. Things like your lug nuts on your tires, you want to make sure they're on really tight and they don't fall off.
She quit her day job as an engineer at DuPont to become an auto mechanic. She was the only woman in the program. At first, it was kind of intimidating, but that didn't last.
You know what Sheryl Sandberg says about leaning in or sitting at the table? I saw myself falling back because I was intimidated. And so I had to make that switch. And when I did, then you couldn't tell me anything.
Going from engineer to mechanic meant a big pay cut. But she says working on cars made her rich in other ways.
Everybody thinks I have to go to a four-year degree, sit at a computer, that's how I'm going to make money. And they don't realize the value in working with your hands.
But Banks was driven by more than the zen of motor vehicle maintenance. She was sick of being taken advantage of at local repair shops and wanted to do something about it.
Felt like an auto airhead. I hated all of my experiences going in for an oil change, being upsold all the time for an air filter. Anytime a dashboard light come on, I'd panic. You know, you hear a noise on your car, you're like, oh no.
The experience inspired Girls Auto Clinic, which is a two-in-one business, an auto repair shop and salon. While you get your car fixed by Banks and other female mechanics, you can also get a mani, a pedi, or a blowout.
That's what I wanted to be like, a clubhouse for women where you can just come and hang out to be around some other dope chicks, right? Yeah.
Among them, Crystal Lewis.
Sure.
She can help you out at the Clutch Beauty Bar.
You could come to next door and get your nails, your feet, and your hair done. And a little waxing and a little makeup. And then you could go to work and then you're all done. You ain't even got to worry about it.
Running this hybrid business is just one facet of Banks' grand vision. She runs a monthly car clinic for women. She has a book on the Girls Auto Clinic coming out next year with Simon & Schuster. And she has a TED Talk called How I Plan to Disrupt the Auto Industry in Red Heels.
I'm a mechanic. I cater to women. I get this because it's so unique and it's so needed. And most of the time, it's like, why hasn't this been done before?
Her free monthly workshops fill up fast. 10 women each session. No question is off limits.
Pop your hood. You're going to learn how to pop your hood. You're going to learn what to touch underneath your car, how to change your air filter, right? How to check your oil.
That's how Philadelphian Susan Sweeney first found Banks.
I did not know that girls can go in the automotive field.
Now she's one of the mechanics at the Girls Auto Clinic. Before fixing cars, she went to cosmetology school, but deep down, she wanted something else.
There's no one in my immediate family that was a mechanic, so my mom was always like, take it to so-and-so, and it was always thousands of dollars. Like, seriously, why?
So these days, she's doing the fixing herself. She says she's learned quite a bit from Banks, who's like a walking how-to guide.
When you tighten down the lug nuts, you go in a star pattern when you're putting them on, not like one, two, three, four in a circle. Some people don't know that, so it's a good tip.
Banks wants to take her Girls Auto Clinic concept nationwide. And she says maybe some of her mechanics will be the ones opening up the new locations.
Let's go open one in Conshohocken or King of Prussia or Delaware or, you know, South Jersey. And now let's start expanding to Houston, to Atlanta, to L.A. I get emails every day from people saying, when are you coming out to L.A.?
But first, she'll have to prove that her business model really works. The garage is open for business, and the salon is waiting for some final permits. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
This weekend, Philadelphia will host a festival of new sacred Jewish music called Shaw Shalet. It's an international showcase of newly composed liturgical music. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports that one of the composers is a young musician from Elkins Park.
Ari Sussman grew up devout in a Jewish congregation in Elkins Park. He went to a Jewish high school, and every year he went to Jewish summer camp in the Poconos, where he eventually became the camp's music director. One year he got badly sick there, unable to get out of his bunk for days. He decided to spend some time writing a song. Original music to an old Jewish prayer, Oseh Shalom, or the prayer for peace. Oseh Shalom has been put to music many times before. Sussman said he wrote this music that would make him feel more at peace while he was sick.
Oseh Shalom to this day is probably the most organic piece I've ever written. It was just one that just felt so natural to write. The biggest reason is that there's no mention of God in the text. It just says the one that makes peace. So I'd like to see that as this universality to it.
Sussman is now 23, studying composition at a conservatory in Boston. His music is one of the 20 selected out of 1,500 submitted to be performed at the Shaw Shalet Festival. It's an international showcase of new liturgical music. Its president, Ramon Tassat, is a cantor in Maryland, and he looks for music that supports its own text, and vice versa. The words must bring out the best in the music.
I'm sure it happens to you, and happens to all of us, that sometimes there is a certain poetry that we wouldn't read alone. But when it's part of a song, we find all of a sudden that we just love this text, and we want to go back and read it now.
The concert of new sacred Jewish music is on Sunday at the Mainline Reformed Temple in Wynwood. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.